Ahoy, Vachon. Or as the French say, Vachon. This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and the weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon. We're located on Vachon Island, which rises above the waters of South Puget Sound between Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington, if you're not familiar with us. That we just heard was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown, and it always makes me kind of return back to the first times I sat here with Brian to chat about current events. And so together we, after his passing, we the Briefly strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing to you every week another episode of intelligent, sort of mainly generally intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. So our current Briefly panel includes former Alaska Airlines pilot, treetop flyer, appliance replacement specialist, and controller of the Voice of Vachon Big Board here in the studio, Vachon Airport Commissioner Truman O'Brien.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
Nice to be here with you.
Thanks.
Also in the studio today, historian, professor, cool cat, and down under aficionado, also skipper of the Vashona, Bruce Hallman.
Good to be here.
Likewise. Let's see, we also legal beagle, scholar, mediator, and
meditator. Could be meditator.
Fellow treetop flyer, Craig Bellis is with us today.
Thank you for that ambiguous introduction.
Absolutely. I know we'll clarify as we go. can I call you a ruckus manager? I'm not sure if I quite got...
I think I like that. I've never heard that before. Again, done by the Brieflies.
There you go. Okay, well, you know, we iterate as we go. Ruckus manager and all-around amazing community activist and our hope for reliable waterborne transportation, Amy Dreyer's here.
Good morning. And good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Good morning. And let us welcome our guest today, Seattle University Professor Emeritus and Global Educator, Consultant, and Researcher, Dr. Larry Hubble is here. Welcome, Larry. I'm glad
you
could join us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Yeah, excellent to see us all here today. I'm Kevin Jones, returning briefly, High Alpine and Salish Sea Wanderer, and also today's host. So, as we normally do, let's just check in and see how things are going with everybody and maybe share with us a favorite moment from the last week or so. Bruce, maybe we could start with you.
Sure. It's just, it's always nice to have Opus back in her slip where she belongs, right next to Vashona.
The wandering, water wandering has stopped
exactly.
For a while.
Opus is Kevin's boat, and it's in the slip right next to my boat, Vashona. So they're sort of partners in the slip, and mm-hmm. when either one of them is gone, it sort of feels like your best friend is missing. So it's nice to have Opus back in the slip. But it's it's not been a particularly special week other than it's a special week on Vashon every week in the summer. I mean, concerts in the park, the lantern walk. I mean, all the kinds of things that are going on. And it just feels like there's never enough time. And even though the sun's up until 9 o'clock at night and up at 5:30 in the morning, it still feels like the days just fly by. But soon enough, we'll be in January and February, and we'll be bemoaning the lost days of summer. But I'm having a great summer, so awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Word to the wise. Enjoy them now. They are fleeting. Truman, no appliance stories, I hope.
No. Okay, this week, no appliance stories this week. Larry's probably going, what are you guys talking about? I had to replace all of the appliances in my house over time. So these guys have heard the woes of my appliance stories. No, I had I spent the week down in Southern Oregon at Ashland for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Mm-hmm. Just had an absolutely wonderful time. Smoke was not great. Boy, they had a couple of huge fires up there just north of Crater Lake, and we got the benefit of all the smoke. And they have there's a scale, I don't know if you guys healthy air scale.
Air quality index.
Air quality index. Yeah. Thank you. That's what I was trying to think of. And it was, you know, running up over 150, which is really high for the basically for the whole week. We did get to two outdoor plays, though, and it subsided enough that they were able to do the plays, which is really great. Much Ado About Nothing, which was fabulous outdoors. But one of the most interesting plays, I have it called up here because I can never pronounce it if I don't look at it. It's Befarahim. Whew. Anyway, it's an Iraqi word. I mean, Iranian word, a Farsi word that is used to mean a whole bunch of different things. But anyway, it's a one-man show of this gentleman from Iran, and was really fascinating. The guy is brilliant, and kind of his life story. He's an immigrant to the U.S., but anyway, nice. Had a great time. So there we are.
Awesome. It sounds like we get an annual update on how the festival there in Ashford is going.
Yeah, well, we go twice a year. We see everything. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, Craig, what's up with you?
Well, thanks for that weather report. My son, daughter, and granddaughter live in Ashland, and I think the air filters that we purchased them over the years are working overtime.
Oh yeah,
in their homes. But my week was interesting. I conducted a hearing all week long with 9 or 10 attorneys in the room, which is always a dangerous thing. But we concluded the hearing on Friday evening, and now we just have some briefs that have to be submitted to the arbitrators and some final argument. But on a lighter note, as soon as I got back, I started attending the Vashon Island Film Festival, independent film festival. As the Briefleys know, we all had representatives of the film festival here. Zach Mann and Mark Sayre were here several weeks ago talking about it, and it was everything and more that they queued it up as, and there were just some tremendous films. I highly recommend that next year, if there's any way you can go. People wonder, you know, what is a film festival? Well, it's just basically, you know, Eileen Walcott has these lined up at the theater, one after another, and they typically are followed up by a question and answer by either some of the actors that were in it or the directors. And these are all films that were like the grand prize winners at Sundance and at Cannes. I mean, these aren't just local iPhone movies. These are top notch movies, and they go the gamut in terms of topics. So I would highly recommend that you try to pick some of those up. And that Truman, you change your date for going to Ashland to not conflict.
Yeah, I know. I was so bummed I was going to miss it. Darn it! I realized it halfway through their interview last week.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was my week.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we just heard from a very satisfied customer.
Yes,
indeed.
All right, Amy, how's things going?
Yeah, going pretty well. I'm kind of with Bruce. I'm celebrating summer as it flies by and eating as many blackberries as I can along the way. I did have the chance to take the passenger boat to Seattle last week and attend the press conference for the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association. And, you know, as fun as it is to take the PO boat because it feels like your own private cruise. It was also great to get into downtown and sort of hear, I do have a little bit of a labor background, you know, kind of spotted in, and always feels like home to return to the unions and connect with the folks who, you know, every time I hear one side of a story, it always feels compelling, right? Until you hear the other side of the story. And it was really great to, you know, connect with the folks who were talking about, you know, hey, I haven't seen my husband in XYZ, or my kids are wondering where I am and summer's almost gone. And, you know, I've been working that much overtime. So really, really compelling event and good to hear from them. And then also just awesome to take a trip to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. I'll be PO boating tomorrow, actually. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. The first, midday, midweek PO. Mm-hmm. First time in, 24 years or whenever, when they started to curtail service. Yeah. Larry, tell us how things have been going with you.
Well, I'm enjoying the summer. And last week, I also took the PO boat to go to Chinatown.
Nice.
And it's nice that there's something available like that during the middle of the day. I really enjoyed it. I used to take it every day, but I haven't taken it for a while. So
yeah,
that was great.
Yeah, I may visit that same area. I'm going to see if the Pinball Museum is still in full swing.
Yeah, so. I haven't seen that one.
It's worth stopping in, actually. Yeah, okay. But we need to make sure that we utilize that service now that we've worked so hard. People have worked
there
so hard.
There were a fairly good crowd. We went over on Thursday, and I was surprised.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, hey, I am just returned not only from boating, but last week I went on a bit of a hike. there's a Lieutenant O'Neill in the Army back in the 1880s, pioneered the route up the Skokomish River, and at least the first person who documented the route. And they actually put in a mule trail, and maybe they were planning on a road. But I got to see an O'Neill Pass and La Crosse Pass and Duckabush, it's like the hydrological epicenter of the Olympics. There's four major drainages that all come out of this one high country. So it's been on my list for only about 20 years. But it does cause me to wonder, what altitude, when you guys are flying your plane, what altitude are you guys running at?
Mm-hmm. It depends on the route.
You know, kind of what the
range depends
is.
If we have power.
Yeah.
If zero to what?
Yeah. If the engine's still running, generally across country will be 5,500 to 6,500, somewhere in there.
Okay, way above. I was just wondering if I was challenging your altitude.
No, but years ago I used to fly for San Juan Airlines.
Yeah.
And one of the routes that we would occasionally fly, we would go from Port Angeles to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the normal route is around down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. But occasionally, we'd go up the back way and go through the mountains. And, boy, the people would love that because it was so scenic.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, pretty fun.
Well, I only gained 12,000 overall, but just a little bit more than the idiot in the upcoming Vashon Passport to Pain, which we're going to hear more about we have a guest from the Vashon Island Rowing Club here coming up in a month or so. Right. But anyway, today is lucky August 13th. It's 5 days until the Virginia 5 cruise around Vashon with the Heritage Museum. 6 days until the start of the Democratic National Convention, which I'm thinking might be pretty exciting this year. Given all the excitement that's going through the country right now. 84 days until the presidential election on November 5th. Do not forget to vote. Tell everybody you know to vote. And I won't say more about that. But 159 days until the presidential inauguration on January 20th of next year. So we shall see what happens. Today, we always want to recognize a special day. We're sandwiched between World Elephant Day yesterday and World Lizard Day tomorrow.
That is an odd combination,
cozy environment.
I have to tell you that one of the plays that we saw was not Shakespeare, but it was called Lizard Boy.
Okay.
And it was quite interesting, So I just had to throw that out.
There's Lizard Boy, Elephant Man.
Elephant Man and Lizard Boy. There you go. Yeah.
Is that going to be at the film festival next year?
It could be. You roll them over on their back and rub their bellies and they go right to sleep.
That's right. I never knew that. You're talking about the lizard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Elephants, no.
Not so much.
Okay. Today also is the date of birth of Felix Wankel. And who knows about Wankel's
I do.
Tell us about his awesome experiment.
Well,
his
Wankel
invention.
Developed the rotary engine. One of the reasons why I know Wankel is when I met my wife. She was driving a Mazda RX-7, which is one of the few cars in the United States that ever commercially actually ran a Wankel engine. But I guess the Wankel engine was developed in association with John Deere.
Actually, the Wankel engine was also in the RX-2, which I had. And it really worked well. You get that thing up around 5,000 RPM, man, it was hauling. I mean, 5,000 RPM, it really cranked. Yeah.
Well, just spinning.
Yeah,
That's interesting. They developed a bigger Wankel here recently, a 1,000 horsepower Wankel that they didn't, they tried to put it into various vehicles commercially. See, that's what you get, Kevin, for asking this question.
I know. You're going to get a whole dissertation.
Okay, can we talk about airplanes?
Can we just say Wankel one more time?
Well,
just,
and of course, Wankel is also a Nazi. I should probably throw that out there.
Full disclosure. Well, I have to say that I was interested that's the only vehicle I've driven that has an audible RPM warning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you can't hear the engine.
No.
Yeah, so, okay. So, pretty interesting car. Today in history, I'm going way back now, 1521. Today, the Aztec Empire officially ended on this day when conquistador Hernan Cortez captured Tenochtitlan, I believe is the way to say that. Now currently named Mexico City, after a 93-day siege, winning Mexico for the crown of Spain. And the other interesting thing on this day, 1919, famed racehorse Man O' War suffered the only defeat of his entire career.
Wow.
So let's put that defeatism behind us and move on with our small talk guest. Today we welcome a good Dr. Larry Hubble, Seattle University Professor Emeritus, and Vashon Islander. And Larry, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
I know it's really been a true pleasure to have been introduced to you by our mutual friend, Bob Hughes. And if I could maybe start out, let our listeners know, you've done a bit of journeying. So how did you arrive on Vashon?
Well, prior to living here, I lived in Wyoming for 25 years as a professor at the University of Wyoming. And while we were there, we had the crazy idea that we were going to buy a little ranchette, I guess you could call it, only 90 acres in Wyoming.
It's small.
Very small.
Yeah, yeah.
And we started raising llamas. So we've been raising llamas now for 20 years, a little over 20 years. And when I got a job at Seattle University as the director of the Institute of Public Service, my wife said, we got to take the llamas with us. Hmm. So that was 10 years ago, and it was difficult.
How many llamas are we talking about?
I started with, we had 14 at our peak, but they're an older herd. So llamas die of the same things that people do, cancer. One had a stroke. So we're down to four now. Mm-hmm. And if you ever go down Wax Orchard Road and you see that llama banner, that's us. So my wife has a small llama business where she teaches people how to weave and whatever. So we didn't know about Vashon. My wife used to come here on a fairly regular basis because the University of Wyoming had a connection with the University of Washington on training medical students. But she had never heard of Vashon. And one day I went through a internet list about the best places to live in Seattle, and Vashon was number two.
Who was number one?
I don't know.
That's racing out of our mind.
And we thought, Vashon is such a unique place in that what other major metropolitan area has a rural area basically adjacent to it? So it worked out perfectly for us. Although I'll have to say, I was the director for 6 years, and I spent most of my time in Seattle, my waking hours, than I did in Vashon. As you can imagine, the trip was about an hour and a half each way. But that's how we ended up here.
All right.
And we're very happy here now.
Awesome. Well, you can get good sleep here, too, for sure.
Yes.
So, Larry, tell us a little bit about your academic career. You've been a Fulbright Scholar. You've taught at the University of Wyoming. You taught at Seattle U. Where did you do your undergraduate work? Where did you do your graduate work? You know, what's your field? What spins your wheels as an academician?
Okay. Well, I got my undergraduate degree in international studies at American University in Washington, D.C. I got my master's in political science at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And while I was working full-time for the federal government and having several kids, wasn't the easiest. I got my PhD at Virginia Tech. Fortunately, they offered courses. They offered courses at night. And I've had a variety of interests. I got my degree in public administration as a PhD. But public administration is like a subfield within political science. So we used to, teach courses that are usually considered straight political science. And one of the ones that I taught, because I enjoy traveling and I enjoy doing research abroad and teaching abroad and also consulting abroad, is a course called Problems Facing Emerging Democracies. Hmm. I didn't think that would pertain to the United States, but it seems to be increasingly so. So I went to a variety of countries that generally had new democracies and was able to interview people, did teaching there in many places, did three Fulbrights. The short-term ones, because I couldn't be away from the llamas that long. My wife wouldn't agree to that. So I went to Sierra Leone, which is it's a tough place because I was there in 2008, and they had had a really brutal civil war 10 years prior to that. One of the interesting things, by the way, of Sierra Leone is here's a country where the rule of law was virtually non-existent, where when the rebels controlled Freetown for 9 months, and during that time, I talked to people, and they said they were afraid to walk outside, especially if you're a woman, because you could be raped. And some people speculated that at the time, roughly after that period, that about 40% of the population suffered from mental illness, you can imagine. And what's amazing about Sierra Leone was I was there in 2008, and the government had just changed hands, and they did it between parties, and they did it peacefully.
Wow.
So it is possible.
It is possible. We can follow the lesson of Sierra Leone, which we call in political science contingent consent, that if a party loses, they look to the future and they say, well, possibly we could win next time. Not that it was fraudulent. So I also went to, did a Fulbright in Lithuania, which is, I like to go to these small countries because you can really get to know what's going on. And Lithuania, of course, is very apprehensive about a possible Russian invasion. One of the advantages they have over the other two Baltic states, Estonia and Latvia, is that they have a very small Russian population, whereas Estonia and Latvia have a very large proportionate Russian population. But there is also that part of Russia that's separate from the main part of Russia, which most Russians take this corridor through Lithuania. So that is of some concern.
Okay, kind of like the Crimea.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And then just recently, and I'm planning to go back there next year, I was privileged to go to Macedonia, another small country. Interesting in that there is a real division there between the minority Muslim population, which is about 28%, and the majority, I guess you could call them Slavic majority. And I teach at one of the two Muslim universities. And it was very interesting. So, and then I've gone to other places too. Went to Cambodia. Did I'm an organization development consultant, among other things. And in Cambodia, what I did was got connected with these rice farmers who were really poor, who had no electricity, no water, and they wanted to start a business because what they found that the women in their village were going down to Phnom Penh. And usually they went there for one of two reasons, either prostitution, because prostitution is a big business in Southeast Asia, or to work in a linen factory. And they didn't want them to leave. So they wanted to create an opportunity. So I was, I used to be a businessman. So I have a variety of different hats. So I actually helped them develop a business plan. They wanted to this was their idea. A eco-tourist resort. And it was an amazing setting because I taught on this grounds of the of Buddhist temple. And it never happened, but it was a very interesting, I went back a second time too, a very interesting involvement with them. And then I taught in Indonesia, China, Russia, shortly after the breakup of the Soviet Union, which was a very difficult time in Russia. Especially for people who are on pensions because they had seen their pensions virtually disappear because the inflation rate in Russia in 1992 was something like 1,900%.
Wow.
So, and then Taiwan, China, South Africa, where I spent a year there as a kid, 17 years old, was fully exposed to apartheid South Africa and authoritarianism. This is the thing about authoritarianism. It affects all aspects of life. And there I was going to school. And the school system, as you can imagine, was highly authoritarian, where boys would be whacked with a cane if they got out of line. And there was it was all based on rote education. There wasn't any emphasis on thinking. They didn't want people to think. They wanted people to obey. That was the implicit message that the South Africa. And then I went there three times after, shortly after Mandela was freed from prison. I went there in 91, also 93 and 97 as an academic.
Amazing tour de force.
Yeah, right. Wow. So I know you said that you spent 25 years teaching in the University of Wyoming. I'm originally from West Texas, and we have a similar population in that part of the country as you do there in Wyoming. So how can you contrast that lifestyle versus what you're finding here on Vasha?
Well, I have to say that I'm used to living in a variety of different...
Oh, yeah.
I grew up in Chicago. Under the reign of Richard J. Daley.
Oh, boy.
And I lived in Washington, D.C. and went to school there for about 13 years. I used to own an inn in New Hampshire and lived there for 3 years, a very conservative area in northern New Hampshire. And, you know, I was in Wyoming. Now, actually, I'm glad I'm not there right now because Wyoming went for Trump more than any other state in the country. Over 70% of the vote went for Trump in 2020. So my students weren't that conservative. They were the more liberal group, at least on them, when you compared them to Wyoming's conservatives. So it's one thing I can count on is that there are fewer people going to be carrying guns around here as compared to Wyoming, very gun happy state, which I don't miss. And so I'm used to, I mean, lived in South Africa. You don't get any more further to the right than Afrikaners in South Africa during the period of apartheid. So, yeah, I'm used to living in a variety of different environments.
You know, I got a couple of questions and probably a couple of comments. First of all, I want to congratulate you on your telescope.
Oh, thank you. Except he spells it differently. H-U-B-B-L-E. That's the Canadian spelling.
Yeah. Well,
you could have fooled all of us. Just say thank you.
Yeah. I'm related to Carl Hubble, if you have any baseball fans out there.
Oh, yeah.
Distantly related.
But it's working. There's only been one repair that I know
that,
of.
Well, yeah, right. I wish I could take credit for it.
That's right. And were you and Bob Newhart were good friends?
People always talked about Bob Newhart, but it was more like if you ever saw Fawlty Towers.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It's closer to that than Bob Newhart.
That's funny. Actually, I had an opportunity to look at your extensive resume. I understand you conducted a bunch of interviews with some rather influential individuals, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that program, what that was all about, who was your favorite interviewee, and can we listen to any of those?
Yes, you can. I think most of them are on YouTube. They were televised by Seattle TV, and especially in the last two or three years, they really went in whole hog for this. And we only used to have one camera in the back that would shoot everything. And then they brought in three cameras and became much more user friendly. I did it with my person you might be familiar with, Joni Balter. Who is she's a regular on panelists on radio, and also used to work at Seattle Times and works for Bloomberg News. And in the old days, we would say that she had a very full Rolodex. We don't use Rolodexes anymore, but she knew a lot of people, and she was able to arrange, you know, get people to come because we couldn't pay them anything. This was a very low budget operation. And
sounds familiar.
yeah. You know, so I'm used to being on the other end of the interview. We got the Governor Inslee three times. We got the past three mayors of Seattle. We got Rick Wilson. He works for the Lincoln Project, a reformed Republican. We got him because he was selling a book. So we were able to get him to come to Seattle. My favorite interviewee was a guy who has passed away a few years ago and was just a wonderful person on an individual basis, and the people loved him, and that was Bill Ruckelshaus. Bill Ruckelshaus and Gary Locke were on a panel together, And it was during the early days. I was sort of preempting the impeachment charge of Trump. And I think we had them on 2018, and we asked, you know, about the possibility of impeachment at that time. At that time, it seemed remote. He was able to commit enough crimes. That's
a great opportunity to meet those people.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, we've had a few of those people you've mentioned, but we're working on more, so yeah. We'll see. But that's quite an illustrious.
Yeah, we also had most of the congressional delegation.
Yeah.
Including, I think I've interviewed Pramila Jayapal four times.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And, we had Vin Gupta. He's the medical expert.
Right.
Yeah.
Professor at University. He was a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Everybody knew his name during the last couple
the
of years.
Yes, right. Yeah. He was on frequently.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let me change direction here slightly. It's my understanding that you're a musician.
Yes.
And you play with a band or played with a band
long
called Leap and Larry and the Home Wreckers.
That's right.
It's a great name.
Yeah.
Are you Larry?
I am Larry. Yes, I was the lead singer.
Okay. And do you sing or do you, I mean, you sing, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you play an instrument as well?
No. I had a tambourine.
All right. Your voice is your instrument.
That's correct.
That's right.
I was, from the time I was a kid, I was in choirs. And throughout high school, grade school, college, sometimes after college. And I used to own this inn. It was 22 bedrooms. Quite a big place, a lot to heat. 85-seat restaurant, 50-seat pub. I did it when I was pretty young, in my late 20s, early 30s. And I was this guy coming from Washington, D.C., former bureaucrat, and the locals were, you know, basically working-class people, a lot of loggers, some hippies, some very rich people.
Familiar, doesn't it?
Sounds like Vashon.
Yeah, except much more conservative.
Not as many loggers, maybe.
No. Yeah. There are a lot of, I got to know the loggers very well. And had some difficulty accepting me. So I wanted to basically crash their stereotypes about me. And I used to wear, you must have seen this on my website. I don't usually talk about this very much. But I used to wear just a black bodysuit. And I'd be up there on stage, and we would sing the Rolling Stones and Chuck Berry and the Doors, some Janis Joplin. So, I have to say, you know, gives you a tremendous boost to your ego. They have people just exuberant about your performance. And so we did it for about a year and a half. Yeah. But I haven't been Leaping Larry for 40 years now.
So the band, your backup band is back.
Yeah.
Back on the East Coast?
Well, I don't think they're a band anymore.
Okay.
Formed us one night when I started doing open mic night. And then we just sang some songs. And we thought, maybe we can do this on a regular basis. So,
Are you familiar with The Coop?
I was just going to ask.
The Coop.
No.
How long have you lived on the island?
10 years.
Yeah, it's very common. There are people who lived here for 50 years who don't know about The Coop. The Coop is a roadhouse, a juke joint on the island that the musicians get together with ad hoc and sometimes planned and whatnot. And they have a house band, which is fabulous.
Really?
House
mm-hmm.
band. And once a month, and more than once a month, they have a thing at the last Thursday of the month.
Really?
Last Friday of the month, they have a theme night. And they put about 20 to 25 people up there who signed up on a particular theme. And I don't play an instrument, but I get up there and sing, backed up by this fabulous band. It can make anybody look good if we all have chosen the same key.
And which is always a trick, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. You should. I'll put you in touch.
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah.
They may be following up. They know where you live now. With
a lot of people know that sign. They're going down Wax Orchard Road.
Yeah. Okay, they're going to knock on your door. I bet pretty
right.
quick. I will have to maybe just do a little follow up on that because you mentioned that you had this cultural wall to get through.
Yes.
And I have to say that my wife, Susie, her grandparents grew up in Luray as like, I don't know, they've been there since the 18 or 17, whatever, right? And they had a very jaded perception of city folks.
Uh-huh.
So totally. I'm thinking, okay, that reminds me. Also, I was thinking about, you know, the first time I think I ever saw Troy Kindred was when they were, I think, I don't know if they called it the Back Bay Inn at the time or if they changed to the Burton Inn,
right.
But they had dining out on the patio,
yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden this guy breaks into song, and it's like,
what?
Okay,
sometimes it's hard to resist that temptation.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. So yeah, totally. I'm kind of getting in the vibe for how that was working for you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so current affairs and authoritarianism, right, seem to intersect. So kind of a just, you know, listening to your history, right, and your academic history and what you study and where we are now, just real simple yes or no question. Seems like civilization has been sort of enthralled by authoritarianism. Since we came around, right? Mm-hmm. And then came monotheism and consolidated it, right? And then we had colonialism, right? And now we're sort of post-colonial, right? And with our kind of not necessarily new democracy, we're a very old democracy now, right? So in kind of as you've studied the rise and fall of authoritarianism through all of these different, you know, ways that nations can be owned, occupied, ruled, what's going on in 200 years into our democracy that we're once again enthralled by the strong man, right?
Yeah, it's really bothersome. In fact, this is one of the topics I'm going to be going over in my course teaching at the OSpace, in that I think you have a large segment, not a majority, but a large segment of the U.S. population, mainly non-college-educated white males, who have been basically left behind economically, whereas other groups, which I am one, have done very well. And unfortunately, from the sort of mega trends that are, it's not just here, it's happening in France, it happens in my ancestral land of Sweden even, where the right wing is becoming more powerful. In Italy, where a fascist mm-hmm. is the prime minister, who's now sort of modified her views somewhat to be acceptable to NATO. I think there are some structural reasons why this is occurring. And what I find particularly disturbing is I don't see real improvement on the horizon. And some of the, broadly, the things that I think are causing this shift in wealth is one, something that's been going on for a long time, globalization, where a lot of white working class people and black working class people lost their jobs. And the industries were sent over to other countries where they could produce it much cheaper. You know, by the way, incidentally, when I was in China once, I went to a factory, a textile factory. And I talked to the manager there, and I said, well, how's your business? And he said, it's not very good. And I said, why? He said, well, and this was not a place where workers were particularly well paid. They lived in the factory. He said, well, it turns out that in Vietnam, they're paying their workers one-tenth of what I'm paying my workers.
Whoa.
So I'm no longer competitive. It's often the search for the lowest possible labor cost labor force. So that's one thing. Another thing that I see as a mega trend is global warming. As you see more areas that are generally poor, where people can't survive, you see this in Central America a lot, is that people want to move to areas where they can get a job. Of course, Trump has made this a big issue. What I'm always amused by is that when I was in Lithuania, they weren't concerned about people getting in. They were concerned about people leaving. Because one-sixth of the population left Lithuania after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So it's not a problem. I mean, if you've got people who want to come there, it means you've got something that you're offering. And then, let's see, the last case is something that I need to educate myself more on, but it's artificial intelligence. It seems to me that the jobs that are most likely to be replaced as a result of artificial intelligence are lower wage jobs, repetitive jobs. Not that, you know, some white collar jobs will also be eliminated. But those three factors, there needs to be a global strategy to deal with that. Because as I see it, you're just going to continue to see greater division between what people make, what they earn.
So that brings up, you know, is there a solution? And if so, what in the world can we do about it? I mean, where can we go? How can we move?
Well, I think government has to be an actor. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked for government for 10 years. I believe in it. I used to work for the EPA.
Yeah.
And an organization named Action. By the way, I used to work for John Lewis on his immediate staff.
Wow.
When he worked at Action. Government needs to be an actor. There has to be also, I think, you know, there's been a rollback. There's been a slow rollback on the part of the Republicans to roll back what occurred first, really, during the New Deal. And what occurred was redistribution of income and more regulation. How often do we hear deregulation? It sounds good, right? Mm-hmm. Industry leaders love it. But it results in a lack of safety, poor quality of foods, whatever. And redistribution of income. I mean, remember, before Reagan, people who, the upper tax limit break, or the upper tax rate was 70%.
Startling. Yeah, to 70. Think about that today.
In the 50s, under a great radical Eisenhower, it was 90%.
Wow.
And now it's, I think, 37%, the highest rate. And of course, you have Social Security, which is the most regressive tax. It only taxes people up to, what is it now, 160,000 or something. And those people above that don't pay any more tax. So, yeah.
So, you know, just sort of follow up, Truman, when you were talking earlier, Larry, there's several things came to mind for me. One, there's, in our state of Washington now, we have the Clean Energy Transformation Act. And mm-hmm. amongst other things, that means about January 1st of next year, when you turn on the lights, you're not turning on a coal-powered, mm-hmm. Coal-fired power plant. Mm-hmm. And in another decade, it's going to be, you're not going to generate any carbon emissions. It'll be carbon neutral. And so that was a law that's now on the books. And along the way in that conversation, you've got a utility like Puget Sound Energy, largest in the state, thinking about, okay, now I have these assets that I have to close, and I have a workforce that I have to transition. And there was a lot of conversation about a just transition. And mm-hmm. what does that look like? And a lot of our coal power now comes from Colstrip, Montana. And the people who work at Colstrip, Montana, a number of them, I don't know what percentage, are from an indigenous tribe in a nearby reservation. And the question of, what are they going to be left with? Are those the types of conversations that we overlooked in globalization? And do you think that might be a key to move us in a more equitable direction in the future?
It's, when a society shifts, and what we're seeing is these three shifts occurring. Some people lose out. Now, what the government needs to do is to step in. For example, for those people who might lose their jobs, government needs to be very active in subsidizing or at least providing training to people so that they can readjust. It used to be that, like, if you were growing up in Michigan and you were your father worked at General Motors or whatever, and you looked forward to a job that was going to pay you very well. You were going to be a member of the middle class. Those days are gone. There are many fewer workers now who are working in Michigan. So the government, I remember Nixon. I thought Nixon would be the worst president we ever had. I was wrong.
I wonder who may replace. Does anything come to mind?
Yeah.
I shouldn't ask.
Yeah. We need to. But back then, people used to have a fairly good view of government. And frankly, I think that, I actually wrote a paper on this. With Nixon and his disgraceful conduct in office, and then with Reagan, Reagan continually characterized federal bureaucrats and all bureaucrats, basically, except that they work in the defense for the Pentagon, as you know, monsters, or they were stupid, or they were lazy. It was always negative stereotypes. And I think the Republicans have fostered this. So this is a sort of a back. People don't want to give up their Social Security. They don't want it reduced. The Republicans have tried that several times, and maybe during Project 2025, well, if, my God, if Trump's elected, that could happen. But it's easier to attack the people who provide the service than to attack programs that are very popular, like Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So two questions. One, you're going to be teaching this course at the O-Space, so I want to come back to that. But
yeah.
One of my other things is in authoritarian regimes, they're very authoritarian until they're not. And when they're not, they just collapse really rapidly. Do you have some insights? Do you see that's happening right now with Kamala coming on board? And, there just seems to be a shift in sentiment in the United States right now. And Trump doesn't seem as invulnerable as he was at one point. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I was very, as many people were a month ago, extremely pessimistic and starting to wonder now, should I really leave the United States? Or if I'm on Vashon, will that give me, enough of a safe space? I got off on that tangent.
Well, the idea that autocrats, when they fall, they fall quickly. I mean, Joe McCarthy was in the driver's seat, and then bam, one hearing, and he's out, basically.
Right.
You know, after World War II, they're laughing at Hitler in Germany. Yeah. You know, same thing in Italy.
The main problem that I see authoritarians have is they have a lack of legitimacy. There is a very famous sociologist named Max Weber, and he talks about the three sources of power. One is charisma, which is usually what authoritarians play off of. I wouldn't say Trump is particularly charismatic, but his followers are cult-like. Mm-hmm. The other is traditional, which is, you inherit it from your kings. We don't have too many kings left. And the other is, which is what democracy is supposed to be based on, is a rational legal system, the rule of law. I mean, I've been in country, Sierra Leone, where if you drove, we were stopped several times by the police for bribes. I mean, that is just something that's accepted in many countries. We used to be, I'm not sure we are as much as we used to be, famous for our support for the rule of law. That is so important. It's implicitly built into people's minds. It's becoming less so now. When you have someone who disputes elections and then puts people on election boards who are election deniers, I'm offended, as are a lot of people are really offended, that this would occur. Now, I'm so excited that Kamala Harris is the nominee. The polls have really turned around, especially in three of those key swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And I think she's going to win. And I think maybe, let me put my neck out here, it might be a bit of a landslide.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You keep talking about those things that make the authoritarian popular, but I don't see any charisma whatsoever with Donald Trump, and I know that I have a good friend back in Montana who said my wife hates the guy but she's got to vote for him, and I'm like, well, why? Well, I don't get it. I mean, I don't think the business end of it really is working. I mean, what is the draw? I don't get it. Does anybody know?
Well, let me make one suggestion, and that is, he's got a good propaganda network.
Well, there's a
in Fox News and One America News and Newsmax.
Right.
You've also got people who are sufficiently irritated. He had a new message. It was different than the traditional Republican message. And how a billionaire from Queens can win the devotion of people in West Virginia is a little bit beyond me, but he has. And I think that base is rock solid. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that you need to do, too, is when we talk about authoritarianism, and I don't want to tell you about your business, Dr. Hubble, but you know this well. It's not just the leader. It's the followers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's all part and parcel of it, and the attributes that they have and the attributes that they like and the attributes that they feel they need, that makes the difference
yes.
here. So.
And he also has... not only the followers, he has a lot of enablers.
Yeah, yeah.
Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy denounced the January 6th riot and then later went back on that. Yeah. He's got the whole Republican Party basically in his back pocket because they're afraid of being primaried out. He's got now the Supreme Court.
Yeah. You know, I one thing that struck me, I recently was at the airport, you know, and getting away from this environment. And there was this young man that was sitting next to us, and he was from Eastern Washington, and obviously quite a different political view. And he noticed a woman with this weird hairdo, you know, haircut, and you know, it was a lot of tattoos, and you know what I'm talking about. And he made some comments about, oh, nice haircut or whatever, you know. It's like, it's that whole attitude of us versus them thing, mm-hmm. I think, that maybe is part of that.
Yes.
That really struck me.
That is key to demagogues.
Yeah. Displaying, point of view. Displaying aggression toward right. out-group members
yes.
is a
yes.
common characteristic.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
You have an in-group, mm-hmm. and you have all demagogues, all authoritarians have an out-group. Ones that the in-group is supposed to disdain. It's a lack of tolerance for different points of view and just different lifestyles.
Right.
And mm-hmm. it's not democratic.
No.
Yeah. I was introduced suggested I follow up with a gentleman named Jerome A. Powell, I believe his name is. And he talks about othering mm-hmm. and how sophisticated that is and how insidious it is and how dangerous mm-hmm. it is. So if anybody in our audience here says, I'd like to learn more about how to understand that risk, then that is a resource you might look up.
And one of the things that Trump is very effective at is repeating the same message
right.
over and over again. Now, I watch MSNBC a lot, so I get it more than most, I think. But that's what a propagandist does. That's what the Nazis did in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
But the message has a limited shelf life.
One would hope so.
Regimes. I mean,
Bruce, you need to get next to the mic, please.
I mean, you look back in history, I mean, authoritarian regimes, they don't last very long for the most part. I mean, some do in small countries, but, you know, larger countries, because the message gets old.
Well, we almost eliminated this problem with an assassination attempt. But with that, do you think that would change is the momentum already going in that direction? Or if he steps down or if it goes away, whatever, is that going to end the whole MAGA thing?
Well, it might. I don't think it'll end it, mm-hmm. but I do think it might lessen its impact.
Impact, yeah.
Because people are, I mean, look what happened to Ron DeSantis. He mm-hmm. hoped to be the new Trump. Now, of course, he was running against Trump. But my thought is that it will still be around, but perhaps with less impact mm-hmm. after Trump is gone. I don't see anybody waiting in the wings who is a Trump
J.D.
substitute.
Vance? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, talk about, I certainly don't see his charisma, but I do understand it. And I'm just going to say something, just come along on my journey with me on this. Trump is like very good art, right? Mm. Everybody looks at him and has a very different reaction, but they have a reaction and they have a big reaction, right? It's visceral, whether you like it, you don't like it, you love it, you want it hanging in your house, right? kind of deal. And so for sure, I think like there is no Trump. There have been many people trying to pretend that they are, but there, you know, he is the Mona Lisa of what he is, right? Yeah. But I kind of wonder, how long have we actually been trending towards authoritarianism? And is Trump really, truly our sort of foray into it recently? Or have, you know, let me ask a question that doesn't seem loaded at all. Have many people in many states been living under authoritarianism in America for a long time?
Well, I think if you were black living in the South prior to the 1960s, that you certainly were living under the rule of authoritarians. We, in the 30s especially, there was Father Coughlin, who had a tremendous radio following, who was an overt racist and fascist, and Huey Long on the left, who was going to run for president but then was assassinated in 1935, who also was quite clearly authoritarian. The German-American Bund during the 30s was also, they drew a big crowd once at Madison Square Garden. And you saw various movements on the left also.
I mean, if you read Amy, oh gosh, what's her name? Skipping my head right now. The historian who does a letter from the American.
Heather Cox Richardson.
Heather Cox Richardson, yeah. I mean, she looks at that sense of Americans always has had an authoritarian strain within it, you know, whether it be the slaveholder sort of autocracy in the South, you know, whether it be, you know, the sort of 30s fascist in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, McCarthy in the 1950s, there's always been that strain in American politics, but it's never been able to totally dominate. You know, it's ultimately been overthrown.
One of the things that I'm going to review in my course is how previous presidents in certain instances worked in a behaved like an authoritarian, and their sort of their authoritarian moment, they were, I don't think, anything like Trump, how it was blocked effectively in many cases by either the courts, the Congress, or the American people.
So, Larry, you should definitely let everybody know how to get in touch with getting to that course that you're planning to put together.
I can put a little advertisement in here. Yeah, it's going to be offered at the O Space. It's free, but they do accept donations. It'll be on start on September 19th, and then every other Thursday, September 19th, October 3rd, October 17th, but not on Halloween. We don't want to step in the way of the Halloween parade. So it'll be on October 30th then. And then we'll either be, the last one will be on November 7th, 2 days after the election. Hopefully it'll be decided by then. We'll either be mournful or we'll be ecstatic. So I don't know exactly what is, that issue will be, we'll cover what's next.
And are there places people can look to find out, like,
I think you'll be seeing, they're doing some advertising on it.
So O Space may have something up on their website and social media, perhaps?
Yes, they're covering that part of it.
Got it. Okay. Of course, we have the Beachcomber and other places. So if you are inspired by this conversation, and I think it's just fabulous discussion we've had, and really appreciate you getting in touch and saying, hey, let's have this talk. There's more to follow,
right?
In more depth, so we can have the opportunity to actually meet.
Oh, and I may add
person.
One thing about that.
Yes.
It won't just be me lecturing, because I can go on for hours about this. I'm limiting it's going to be an hour and a half each time we meet. The first 45 minutes to an hour, I'll be talking. And then, you know, typically you have people in the audience ask questions of the speaker. Well, instead, I'm going to turn it around like it's a class. I'm going to ask questions of the audience related to that issue.
Nice.
And I'd like them to respond.
All right. We will look forward to that. And it's free. Just drop in, sounds like?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful.
And you've got to have Dr. Bruce Hallman as one of your guest speakers.
Oh, that would be sweet.
I tell you, you guys working together, it's got to be absolutely fascinating. I can't wait.
Well, I was thinking about it the last session, having somebody, people come in and serve as a panel, and then making it very interactive with the audience.
So we are down to like our last 60 seconds here.
Okay.
I don't want to leave today without recognizing that last Tuesday, Kamala Harris officially secured the 2024 Democratic presidential nomination. She will be the first woman of color in U.S. history to lead a major party ticket. Amy, you like to just share with us your thoughts about where we're at in this moment in time?
It is joyous and overshadowed at the same time, sort of, right? And I think, you know, we're on our hero's journey from my perspective, and we still live under the shadow. We're still sort of, you know, waiting for that triumphant moment in the film with bated breath. But great segue. I think I just confirmed Rita Brogan to join me on August 27th here on The Briefly to talk about this moment and talk about, you know, where we are and where we've been and where we might be going.
Thank you for your willingness to share your insights and perceptions on where we're at in our historic journey. So for Larry, Amy, Bruce, Craig, Truman, and myself, I'm Kevin. I'm looking forward to an exciting discussion as the Briefly go forward. Join us next week. Thank you.